Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. We're about to have a conversation with Harriet Washington. She's a medical ethicist. She's author of this book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, which won the 2007 National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. She's been a visiting scholar at DePaul University School of Law, a fellow at the in medical ethics at Harvard Medical School, and a night fellow at Stanford University, and joins us here during our drive. And Harriet Washington, welcome. Good to have you at the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm very happy to be here.
One of the things that really struck me in this book is that I made up a subtitle for the book. And the subtitle I made up was, Tuskegee was just the tip of the iceberg. And because it didn't begin there, and it certainly didn't end there. Because we have this popular wisdom, you know, we have this popular wisdom that experimentation, medical experimentation on African Americans was Tuskegee, but that's not it.
Right, that is a common misconception. Even I was surprised to find that even among the histories, experts in the area, history of medicine people, frequently in around 2005 when I spoke to experts in the field and told them I was doing a book about African Americans in medical research, they would respond by saying, oh, Tuskegee, you're writing about Tuskegee.
Right.
And that sort of reveals the depth of ignorance, sometimes willful ignorance, around this subject matter that even most of the experts were completely unaware of much of this history.
So then let's take that back. I mean, because I think that before we jump into Tuskegee, which we'll do because you write about it extensively, but I think that's important. Obviously it is. But let's go back to this whole idea of the connection between slavery and experimentation on this kind of scientific racism. I mean, the part you write about what happened to slaves during that period was, you know, we read and say what happened in the Holocaust to Jews and others who were experimented on. But nobody ever thinks or talks about the horrendous experimentation that went on during slavery.
Yes, there certainly has been a hole in medical, history of medicine writing regarding this subject. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, there's been this disproportionate ignorance of the subject on a failure to examine what happened during enslavement. And it was really not that difficult to find. I think that it was just only common sense that the horrific physical and psychological abuses of slavery would certainly have extended into the medical sphere, because one of the things I point out is that medical researchers, it's not that they were venal people any more than anybody else. But what happened to Black people simply reflects in the medical arena what was happening to them outside the medical arena. So in an era when we had slavery as the law of the land and Black people were enslaved, you also had people enslaved within the medical system. That's not terribly surprising. It was constant with practice. But for whatever reason, there has not been much of a spotlight shown on this until my book was published. And I'm, my fervent hope is that it's going to be the catalyst, for more studies in this area.
I would hope so, too. I mean, I know you've done this countless times in your interviews, but talking about that, I mean, talk a bit about how the theory that you come up with about how much of this was an underpinning to justify slavery as well.
Right.
And it couldn't have existed without this kind of a medical underpinning in some ways.
It's absolutely true. One of the things that I was very careful to do, I thought it was really important, is I wanted to write the book for anybody who is interested, but I was very careful to document the book for scholars, which means that I only use certain types of supporting documents, supporting proofs, and evidence. And one of the really interesting things is if you look at the writings of white antebellum doctors themselves, they are essentially confessing to the things I put in this book. During this period, it was not considered improper or evil to abuse Black people in the medical setting. So they were very frank about the things they did. Dr. Josiah Knott wrote that the most profitable practice is that among slaves. Many other slaveholding physicians and physicians who did not hold slaves but practiced in the South understood that their economic well-being was tied to slavery, as Dr. Knott suggested. It was tied to slavery because being a doctor was a very different profession back then. They did not have the social clout that it has today. It didn't have the financial rewards it has today. There were doctors who were essentially starving. They could not find enough patients. And in the South, to have enough patients meant to contract with planters to care for their slaves. That's where the money was. And the money was tied not necessarily to keeping these slaves healthy. The point was to keep these slaves fit for work. For example, life insurance companies eventually refused to insure the lives of slaves. They were afraid, or they would not insure their lives for the full value of the slave, because they were afraid, their research had shown them, that slaveholders would sometimes allow that slave to die in order to collect the money. When a doctor treated a slave, he would be paid a nominal sum, perhaps a dollar, for treating a slave with malaria. However, when the doctor was called to court to testify about a slave's fitness for work, say an owner complained that he bought a slave, was assured that the slave was sound and fit for work, and only later found that the slave was sick, a doctor called to testify for either side on behalf of the court case would earn $50. There's much more money in certifying fitness for work than there was in treating disease. Treating disease is something that owners usually did on their own or had their wives or other slaves do. They didn't want to spend much money on it. And another way in which the medical system supported the slave system was by telling the world, the American School of Ethnology was a group of scientists and doctors who wrote in medical journals and popular journals telling the world who black people were. And they said black people probably belonged to a different species. They said that black people were less intelligent, that they were sexually irresponsible and were always engaging in sexual behavior, even the women, that black people were beneficiaries of special immunity. They didn't die from yellow fever or malaria. They didn't get heat stroke. They were able to work long hours in the hot subtropical southern sun without getting sick. They were uniquely suited to work on the field, places where white men would die from disease or overwork or heat sickness. They were said black people, their natural habitat being Africa, they were made to work in these areas. So that's an obvious case where medicine was supporting the slave system with these medical theories of imaginary immunities. There are also imaginary diseases. The imaginary diseases were things, the symptoms were things like talking back to a white man, striking a white man, refusing to work, destroying the owner's properties, and running away, which was called trypanosomia. So these black diseases, having, you know, they all had something important in common, which is a lack of enthusiasm for slavery. So a black slave who refused to be a slave immediately had a psychiatric diagnosis. So that's some of the myriad ways in which the medical system supported the system of slavery and ensured its health while condemning African Americans to early death and chronic disease.
We're talking with Harriet Washington. Her book is Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation of Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. We can make a brief break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the men who practiced what Ms. Washington was talking about, Dr. James Marion Sims, Dr. Walter F. Jones, which will shock you, and people I'm calling their direct descendants that are also in this book. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking with Harriet Washington about her book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, which won the 2007 National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. She's a medical ethicist, has worked at DePaul University, Harvard Medical School, Stanford University, and more, and raises issues that we all have to wrestle with in today's world. And where we left off, when I mentioned those two men's name in Orlando Andy and Dr. Albert Kligman, just take a minute, though, to talk a bit about who they were and what they did, to give our listeners a sense of that, before we talk about some of the more subtle and dangerous things that are going on.
Orlando Andy was a neurosurgeon, and he performed some really egregious surgical procedures that victimized black children. For example, there were young black boys that he wrote about, including one case. He was so proud about it, he wrote it up twice. And it was a young boy, I think around 6 years old, who had quote-unquote behavior problems. But when you read the paper, psychologist detailing exactly what these behavior problems were. And as I point out, if someone says a young black boy has behavior problems, you really have to look at that within the context of a very narrow sphere of acceptable behaviors for black boys during the 50s and 60s. So we don't know whether this boy actually had a psychological problem, or maybe his problem was that he was a young black boy under strict scrutiny, and the normal behaviors of six-year-old boys, which can be quite irritating sometimes, were pathologized. In any event, Dr. Andrew took this as a reason for repeatedly taking out parts of this boy's brain. This was not the only patient he did this to. He did it to quite a few. These were institutionalized children, and very often institutionalized children are quite vulnerable. They don't, their parents, they're wards of the state, and their parents are not there to try to protect them. They don't have private physicians to try to protect them. And being a ward of the state can be risky because sometimes the people posing to do the experimental work on you are also state employees. I see a real conflict there. Your alleged advocate in this institution might be someone who's also supposed to be the advocate for hundreds or thousands of other people and has no way of being an effective advocate for you. So in any event, Dr. Andy wrote in medical journals quite proudly of how he took out bits of brains of young black boys until, like this boy, they eventually became silent and tractable. Although even Andy noted that, unfortunately, the young boy's IQ had dropped, of course.
Right.
So this kind of research is, it's not only horrible to know about, but to realize that this was only one child. We don't know how many children. We don't know how many adult men were doing, because black men were targeted by some programs that researched lobotomy. There was one program in California prison in which the protocol or the blueprint for the research specifically stated, look for black men. We're looking for black men, and lobotomies were performed. Parts of the brain, the forebrain, were taken out, and these men's behavior was changed permanently. Their abilities were changed permanently. It was a horrible thing. I called it a murder of the mind, which is kind of a dramatic phrase, but I think if it happened to somebody you love, you might call it that too. So this is a terrible thing that was happening, and black people were, typically black men and boys, were targeted for this kind of research. So that, I think, was inexcusable. And that sort of provides a segue to Kligman's research. He was the head of the Holmesburg Prison Complex Research Initiative. He was a dermatologist, and he began by testing things like cosmetics, which sounds benign until you realize that these tests sometimes were things like, you know, very caustic things that would take out the men's hair, would, erode their skin, leaving them with raw patches on their bodies. I mean, some of this testing was had real significant harm to the men's health, but he quickly branched out from dermatology, and after a while, he was testing psychiatric drugs. He was testing, as he actually was part of the CIA's MK Ultra experiment. So he went quite far afield of his discipline, dermatology, to engage in egregious tests. And the prison testing is especially problematic because prisons are closed systems. It was very hard to know what was going on there unless you're an employee. And the employees were largely complicit with what's going on there. So it was very difficult for the public to know what's going on, so there can't be any outcry about it if they don't know. And I really question whether informed consent is possible in prisons.
Right.
I'm not the only one. It's very interesting that only the United States and New Zealand have ever permitted, I shouldn't say ever, permit research with prisoners. Most countries understand that prisoners cannot give true informed consent. When they say yes or no, they're saying it in an inherently coercive environment. And sometimes researchers admit they didn't even get the consent of the prisoners. Prisoners did not always know what was being done to them. So it was horribly abusive, but it also provides one of the glimmerings of hope, because the reality is that in the mid-1970s, prison research was largely, not completely, banned in this country. In the 1970s, alarmed by the rampant abuses and alarmed by the Tuskegee syphilis study, the government decided that you can do only a very narrow range of experiments in prison, which is a very good thing. So So from mid-1970s until the mid-2000s, to around 2006 or 2007, you couldn't do research in prison, and you still can't, except that now there has been a government panel that has recommended reopening prisons to research. That's a negative development. I hope it won't happen, but I think that it will.
I hope it won't happen as well, but given where we are now, I'm afraid it might. And I think that brings us to what you were talking about earlier in the last few minutes in this segment. I mean, when I look at the fenfluramine experiments in New York, 1990s, when the very first show we ever did here on my show 20 years ago, March of 1993, was on Norplant in Baltimore, Maryland, that you write about in the mm-hmm. book as well, and kind of instituted by very quote-unquote good liberal doctors, physicians, and health people. And then when you write about the AZT being given to African Americans, these are things that have happened in the recent past.
Actually, AZT was initially withheld from African Americans.
That's what I mean. If I didn't say it correctly. That's what I meant. Right.
But that's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because it's the other side of the coin. The fact that a pattern that has been documented in children, and I think also extends to adults, that for African-Americans and Hispanics, they are more likely to be involved in non-therapeutic research, research that's not going to help them. It simply stigmatizes them, and less likely to be involved in therapeutic research. There's a distinction that people often fail to make. Some research is much better than others. And before you go any further, I need to make a point, very strongly. I am not opposed to medical research. I am in favor of medical research. I think one of the large problems African Americans have is that we have too often been excluded or been inappropriately tested in therapeutic research. We need therapeutic research, but it has to be done with consent. It has to be done with respect. It has to be done in a way that we are not suffering disproportionate risk. I just had to get that in there. I think that's a very, very important point, because the worst abuses of the past don't happen anymore. We have new problems, new abuses that are more subtle. But we also need research.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So we're going to take a very brief break and come back for our final segment here, and let's pick up on that point when we come back as we talk with Harriet Washington. The book, Medical Apartheid, Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Welcome back. We're talking with Harriet Washington about her book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, which won the 2007 National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. She's a medical ethicist, has worked at DePaul University, Harvard Medical School, Stanford University, and more, and raises issues we all have to wrestle with in today's world. And where we left off, when I mentioned those two men's name in Orlando Andy and Dr. Albert Kligman, just take a minute, though, to talk a bit about who they were and what they did, to give our listeners a sense of that, before we talk about some of the more subtle and dangerous things that are going on.
Orlando Andy was a neurosurgeon, and he performed some really egregious surgical procedures that victimized Black children. For example, young Black boys that he wrote about, including one case. He was so proud about it, he wrote it up twice. And it was a young boy, I think around 6 years old, who had quote-unquote behavior problems. But when you read the paper, you don't see any expert, you don't see any psychologist detailing exactly what these behavior problems were. And as I point out, if someone says a young Black boy has behavior problems, you really have to look at that within the context of a very narrow sphere of acceptable behaviors for Black boys during the 50s and 60s. So we don't know whether this boy actually had a psychological problem, or maybe his problem was that he was a young Black boy under strict scrutiny, and the normal behaviors of six-year-old boys, which can be quite irritating sometimes, were pathologized. In any event, Dr. Andrew took this as a reason for repeatedly taking out parts of this boy's brain. This was not the only patient he did this to. He did it to quite a few. These were institutionalized children, and very often institutionalized children are quite vulnerable. Their parents they're wards of the state, and their parents are not there to try to protect them. They don't have private physicians to try to protect them. And being a ward of the state can be risky because sometimes the people posing to do the experimental work on you are also state employees. I see a real conflict there. Your alleged advocate in this institution might be someone who's also supposed to be the advocate for hundreds or thousands of other people and has no way of being an effective advocate for you. So in any event, Dr. Andy wrote in medical journals quite proudly of how he took out bits of brains of young black boys until, like this boy, they eventually became silent and tractable. Although even Andy noted that, unfortunately, the young boy's IQ had dropped, of course.
Right.
So this kind of research is, it's not only horrible to know about, but to realize that this was only one child. We don't know how many children. We don't know how many adult men were doing, because black men were targeted by some programs that researched lobotomy. There was one program in California prison in which the protocol or the blueprint for the research specifically stated, look for black men. We're looking for black men, and lobotomies were performed. Parts of the brain, the forebrain, were taken out, and these men's behavior was changed permanently. Their abilities were changed permanently. It was a horrible thing. I called it a murder of the mind, which is kind of a dramatic phrase, but I think if it happened to somebody you love, you might call it that too. So this is a terrible thing that was happening, and black people were, typically black men and boys, were targeted for this kind of research. So that, I think, was inexcusable. And that sort of provides a segue to Kligman's research. He was the head of the Holmesburg Prison Complex Research Initiative. He was a dermatologist, and he began by testing things like cosmetics, which sounds benign until you realize that these tests sometimes were things like, you know, very caustic things that would take out the men's hair, would, erode their skin, leaving them with raw patches on their bodies. I mean, some of this testing was really, had real significant harms to the men's health. But he quickly branched out from dermatology, and after a while, he was testing psychiatric drugs. He was testing, as he actually was part of the CIA's MK Ultra experiment. So he went quite far afield of his discipline, dermatology, to engage in egregious tests. And the prison testing is especially problematic because prisons are closed systems. It was very hard to know what was going on there unless you're an employee. And the employees were largely complicit with what's going on there. So it was very difficult for the public to know what's going on, so there can't be any outcry about it if they don't know. And I really question whether informed consent is possible in prisons.
Right.
I'm not the only one. It's very interesting that only the United States and New Zealand have ever permitted, I shouldn't say ever, permit research with prisoners. Most countries understand that prisoners cannot give true informed consent. When they say yes or no, they're saying it in an inherently coercive environment. And sometimes researchers admit they didn't even get the consent of the prisoners. Prisoners did not always know what was being done to them. So it was horribly abusive, but it also provides one of the glimmerings of hope, because the reality is that in the mid-1970s, prison research was largely, not completely, banned in this country. In the 1970s, alarmed by the rampant abuses and alarmed by the Tuskegee syphilis study, the government decided that you can do only a very narrow range of experiments in prison, which is a very good thing. So from mid-1970s until the mid-2000s, to around 2006 or 2007, you couldn't do research in prison, and you still can't, except that now there has been a government panel that has recommended reopening prisons to research. That's a negative development. I hope it won't happen, but I think that it will.
I hope it won't happen as well, but given where we are now, I'm afraid it might. And I think that brings us to what you were talking about earlier in the last few minutes in this segment. I mean, when I look at the flunfuramine experiments in New York, 1990s, when the very first show we ever did here on my show 20 years ago, March of 1993, was on Norplant in Baltimore, Maryland, that you write about in the book as well, and kind of instituted by a very quote-unquote good liberal doctors, physicians, and health people. And then when you write about the AZT being given to African Americans, these are things that have happened in the recent past.
Actually, AZT was initially withheld from African Americans.
That's what I mean. If I didn't say it correctly, that's what I meant. Right.
But that's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because it's the other side of the coin. The fact that a pattern that has been documented in children, and I think also extends to adults, that for African Americans and Hispanics, they are more likely to be involved in non-therapeutic research. Research that's not going to help them. It simply stigmatizes them. And less likely to be involved in therapeutic research. There's a distinction that people often fail to make. Some research is much better than others. And before you go any further, I need to make a point, very strongly. I am not opposed to medical research. I am in favor of medical research. I think one of the large problems African Americans have is that we have too often been excluded or been inappropriately tested in therapeutic research. We need therapeutic research, but it has to be done with consent. It has to be done with respect. It has to be done in a way that we are not suffering disproportionate risk. I just had to get that in there. I think that's a very, very important point, because the worst abuses of the past don't happen anymore. We have new problems, new abuses that are more subtle. But we also need research.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So we're going to take a very brief break and come back for our final segment here, and let's pick up on that point when we come back as we talk with Harriet Washington, the book Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Welcome back. We are talking with Harriet Washington. Her book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, which won the 2007 National Book Critics Award, and joins us here on the Mark Steiner Show to talk about her book today. Let's pick up. In our last segment, I said that the very first show that I ever did in March of 1993 was on Norplant, which was this given to young black women, girls in high school, to prevent pregnancies, and it caused a huge controversy. But this brings us to the present, and I think you have a great quote in here. I was going to bring out many quotes. We didn't have time, but this was: diverse forms of racial discrimination have shaped both the relationship between white physicians and black patients, and the attitude of the latter towards modern medicine in general. And this is important, because it's not all about Tuskegee. Norplant happened 20 years ago. So talk about this kind of relationship between the past and the present and what's going on now, and why there's still so much deep distrust among communities of color towards the medical establishment.
Okay, well, in terms of how the past relates to the present, we have many examples. Now, you brought up Norplant, which is a very good example, because the reproduction of black women has taken a very interesting spectrum. Now, people usually discuss it in terms of black women, but black men, of course, are equally important here. However, what's happened is that in the past, when, as I mentioned before, slavers wanted women to have children early and often, it added to their wealth. And so Thomas Jefferson said, "I consider a black woman who gives birth every 2 years as profitable as the best worker on the farm." So they were praised for reproduction. When slavery ended, that incentive disappeared, and the perception of African-American fertility took a 180-degree turn, and suddenly it's being castigated. Black men are being castigated as horrible parents. Black women are being castigated as horrible mothers. And we find a very strong focus on wanting to reduce the number of black births. And this continued in many guises. Mississippi appendectomies, when black women were surreptitiously sterilized, they would go have their gallbladder out, or they'd go to give birth to a child, and without their knowledge or permission, the doctor would sterilize them to make sure they had no further children. Horrific abuse. That took place in the past. But Norplant and the foisting of these dangerous productive methods on black women is another manifestation of the same mentality. With Norplant, as you well know, one of the really interesting things is that it's controlled by physicians. It's not a pill that women can choose to take or not to take. It's not a condom that a man can choose to wear or not to wear. This is something that only the physician can control. And Black women who were pressured into having it implanted later found they could not get it removed. Medicaid would not pay for it. Then very often they couldn't afford it. And Black women were repeatedly stalled when they suffered horrible side effects and wanted to have it removed. So it was involuntary, and the focus on Black women was quite racist. People like to invoke the high pregnancy rate of Black women, but if you look at the data, it tells a different story. The high pregnancy rate of teenage white girls is driving the price in this country. It far outshadows the number of babies born to Black girls, and Black girls are the only group for which fertility has been falling consistently over the past two decades, and yet 90% of women on Norplant were women on Medicaid, and places like all Black schools with young girls were targeted for implantation. So it's something that was forced on people, although public health officials would not call it an experiment. That's exactly what it was, because data was being collected on its use in girls. There was almost no data on it before they began giving young girls. And these young girls, as I said before, were targeted in places like Baltimore, which is heavily Black. And then they would look for venues like all Black schools. So it's really a repeat of the Mississippi appendectomy, forced medical control on fertility.
Fannie Lou Hamer's famous quote, "I've had a Mississippi appendectomy."
I'm sorry?
I said Fannie Lou Hamer's famous quote, "I've had a Mississippi appendectomy."
Yeah, Fannie Haber, I began my chapter on reproductive control with her story. You know, she's one of the early victims of this kind of abuse, and she said it galvanized her. That's what said turned her into a political person. So, I mean, there's another example, too. I mean, there are many, many examples, but the one that I find really, I think really resonates with medical people, so I point it out to them a lot, is remember what I said about pain? Mm-hmm. How the belief that Black people didn't suffer pain caused researchers to force them into painful, abusive research without being at all apologetic about it. They don't feel pain anyway. It's not really hurting them. Well, you would think that such a racist, almost laughably racist belief would be gone by now. And we think that it is, but if you look at the data around what happens to people, to Black people who are in pain and are seeking analgesia, repeated studies have verified that they do not get effective pain relief. White people with the exact same symptoms will receive Schedule II drugs, something very potent for their pain, but Black people are often sent away with an aspirin or Tylenol and a note in their chart that they are drug-seeking. I've had personal experience with this. Someone in my family had a very bad injury to his knee that required surgery. But in his initial emergency room visit, in which, the torn ligament was clearly seen, the doctor refused to give him analgesia, gave him a prescription for Tylenol.
Oh, my God.
It was completely insane. Then the other part of the problem is that even when a Black person receives, or Hispanic person, receives a prescription for the appropriate strong drug, I think it's two-thirds of pharmacies in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods don't even carry potent painkillers. They're not even available. So if you go to the pharmacy, you can't get a prescription. You can't get your prescription filled. All of this signals a very strong skepticism about Black reports of pain, a tendency to dismiss Black people who say they're in pain as drug-seeking. In other words, we're denying that Black people have pain. In other words, the medical establishment is today subscribing to the same mentality that the Victorian physicians espoused.
So in the minute,
in the 19th
century. I'm so sorry. I mean, jump on your words.
No problem.
In the minute we have left here, a little minute. Where do we go from here? What do you think? What do we have to watch out for? What is our struggle for the present and the future?
Well, first, as I said before, we've done something very important. Those worst abuses are gone. But right now, informed consent is our big issue for African Americans and also for the rest of the country. There have been multiple laws, I don't have time to detail them now, multiple laws have gone into our canon that say it's perfectly legal to do research on some people without asking their permission, without even asking them. We have studies going on right now, studies going on in the past, in which people who suffered heart attacks, gunshot wounds, any kind of trauma, have been given, say, artificial blood without their permission, without being asked. And in these studies, most of the people that was done to were people of color, were minority people. So this is our big challenge today, to try to stop this legal revocation of informed consent. If we lose informed consent, we've lost everything.
Harriet Washington, this has been just a pleasure talking to you. I want to thank you so much for taking your time, especially doing this fun drive here at WEAA. Harriet Washington's book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, one of the most important works written in the last 20 years, I think, when it comes to race, America, our health, and medicine. Harriet Washington, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to talk to you.